options activity has altered the investment landscape. Get an edge on this massive flow of funds with Tier 1 Alpha's Market Situation Report, brought to you by HedgEye, a daily newsletter of the latest moves in the options market and a weekly webcast featuring myself, Mike Green of Simplify Asset Management, and Tier 1 Alpha's Craig Peterson and David Pegler. Go to HedgEye.com/research for more information.
Hi, I'm HedgEye's founder, Keith McCullough. Thanks for listening to This Real Conversation. If you like what you hear, you will love our investing research. We bring transparency, accountability, and actionable investing ideas to investors big and small. I'll put our investing process and team up against anyone in the world. Please visit HedgEye.com to subscribe and learn a better way to invest. I'm Keith McCullough, and welcome to another Real Conversation. It's my pleasure to welcome who I think is a rare breed, you know, as both a professor, as an economist. Really, it's hard to find another Steve Hanke out there in America, or in the world for that matter. For those of you that don't know, he was the first to call, like, the mega, not only breakout in inflation using his model and his money supply model, et cetera, but also nail how much higher it was going to go. Steve, and welcome, as many people, including many, many economists, were getting nailed. So welcome back. Thanks for making the time. I know we're going to talk about basically everything that you want to talk about on the subject of the economy, inflation, et cetera.
Good to be with you, Keith.
I don't really want to do inflation first, but I don't know if you can actually have a debate or a back and forth on probability of a recession without including inflation. So I'll just give that to you as an opening volley and just get your thoughts on that.
Okay, so I think the way I think about this is the way what are called monetarists think about it, and that is the fuel for the economy is the money supply. And so if you want a model for national income determination, that is where the economy is going. And when I say national income determination, Keith, I say nominal GDP. Now, nominal GDP includes inflation plus the real component. Inflation plus real equals nominal GDP. And if you want to know where that's going, you have to look at changes in the money supply. What's going on with the money supply? The fuel. And that's why John Greenwood and I got this inflation thing right in the first place. We said it might go up to 9%, and actually it went up in June of 2022. It peaked out at 9.1%. So we nailed that.
Yeah, nobody nailed that like you did. I mean, it wasn't even close, Steve. That was your, you know, of all the things you've nailed over the years, that was impressive. But
I would say you're right. There are a few that got the direction of the thing right and said that we were going to have an inflation problem. There were other monetarists like Tim Congdon who were very in the UK, who were very early on the on the scene and also nailed it, but not with this precise 9.1 thing.
Mm-hmm. That was excellent. Like, for people like me that bean count this, you know, stochastically every single day, I mean, I'm by nature going to be behind you on that because I just update it when we get real-time information. So when you first said that 9, I was like, shit, that's a long way from Kansas, and I ain't Toto. Like, that was a real outlier. In 25 years, I haven't seen a forecast like that nail it. But again, it's again very important for people to understand, as you make the case here, that money supply is really the number one factor because that's how you modeled it.
Right. So in a way, okay, the 9 and 9.1, that's kind of water under the bridge, as they say. But what happened next? And what happened next is the money supply started slowing down and actually contracting. And so Greenwood and I changed our tune. We changed our forecast. And we said the inflation story is basically history. And this inflation is going down. And it's going down because the money supply actually has declined since March of 2022 by an unprecedented 4.5%. Mm-hmm. Now, we've only had, Keith, 4 contractions before in the history of the U.S. money supply where it's actually contracted. And those episodes, let me just go back to how far you have to reach back in the history book to get those. 1948-49, there was a little contraction, not as big as the one we've seen now. There was another smaller one in 1937-38. And there also was a huge one in 1929-1933. We all remember that. Mm-hmm. And what happened. And also in 1920-1921, you had a contraction. So what happened in all four of those cases? Well, in all four of those cases, nominal GDP went down. And that means the inflation went down and real GDP went down. Of course, in 1929-1933, we had a great depression. We didn't have a recession. We had a great depression. So in line with that, you ask about what my thinking was about a recession, and John Greenwood and I think that due to this contraction, that a recession is baked in the cake. And the reason for that is, Keith, you put your finger on something that's important. You're watching this data daily in real time, but what's causing that data to move around in real time, day to day, is something that happened maybe a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, maybe even 3 years ago. And what was that? Well, that was changes in the rate of fuel that was being injected into the economy. That's the money supply. So that's why we say it's baked in the cake. Now, it turns out, Keith, John and I were early on calling the recession. We thought it probably would occur late in 2023. Well, it never happened in late 2023. And we did change our forecast. Now, the reason for this big lag is that there had been a huge excess of cash balances that had been built up with the explosion in the money supply, you know, and in 2021, by February of 2021, the money supply was actually growing at 27% year over year, measured by M2. Now, that's an extraordinarily high rate. It's never grown that rapidly year over year before in the history of the United States. So I should say the history of the United States when managed by the Fed since 1913.
Right.
There have been times before that one has grown more rapidly. So at any rate, you had this huge buildup in excess cash balances, and you can measure that by just taking the level of M2, the money supply broadly measured, and divide it by GDP. That's the cash balance. So that excess was way above trend, and it took more time to burn that off than Greenwood and I thought it would take. And that's why the lag is quite extended. It is a long lag, and that's why we changed our forecast and put this recession coming late sometime in 24, this year.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, before we get off on the related thing, inflation. Remember, nominal GDP has inflation plus real. So the real part, we're going to go negative. And inflation, we think by the end of this year, it probably will be at 2%, the Fed's inflation target, or below.
Okay. Good to circle the bases on that. The biggest thing for me, at least in terms of, because I was also, and I don't think you and I were alone, unsurprised on not having a recession, certainly into late 2023. I mean, the difference this time, I don't want to say it's different this time, but it was, is that we had a massive amount of government spending that you and I certainly haven't seen during the last two recessions. So, you know, last year's GDP, I mean, at some points, depending on what quarter, it was a third of GDP growth on a real basis. So, like, to me, I couldn't really model that. I didn't, like, I don't get daily inputs on government spending. And it's not an excuse. It's just what it is. How do you think about that? Because, you know, we had an industrial recession, we had a manufacturing recession, we had a profit recession. There are many, as my friend Lizanne Saunders would say, there were plenty of rolling recessions inside of a non-reported recession, Steve. And then, of course, we had, you know, Chinese recession, European recession, Canadian recession. There's a lot of other recessions where they didn't have big government spending offsets. So I wonder on that topic, on that specific component this time versus prior points of money supply contraction, is that different, the government spending piece?
Well, the key thing to remember there is that money dominates. It's what's going on in the money supply that dominates. In other words, if you had a fiscal expansion, for example, and a big deficit occurring, and at the same time you had the money supply contracting or slowing way down, the economy would slow down because money dominates. Mm-hmm. And the way to get the fiscal picture in there is as follows, and we can do that at the start of COVID, the best way to think about it. We had massive increases in government spending, and the deficit, of course, ballooned out. And how was that financed? Well, the government spending can be financed by increasing taxes. Well, that wasn't the case, and we had a deficit as a result. And the deficit can be financed by selling bonds to the non-bank public or selling the bonds to the Fed and monetizing the debt. About 90% of the increase in the fiscal deficit that occurred during the pandemic period was actually financed by the Fed. Mm-hmm. The bonds were sold to the Fed, and the Fed credited the government, and the money supply increased because of those credits were for those bonds actually went into increased deposits in the banking system. So the money supply measured by M2 went up, and that's why it went up to 27%. Mm-hmm. If they would have sold all the bonds to Keith and Steve, what would have happened? We would have written a check to the government, our deposits at our banks would have gone down, the money supply would have gone down, and we would have received in exchange bonds.
Right.
And so in that case, you would be actually squeezing the money supply. You wouldn't be increasing the money supply. So you have to disentangle exactly how the government spending is actually being financed to figure out things. And the key to that is how much of the deficit created by government spending or overspending is monetized by the Fed, mm-hmm. increasing the money supply, increasing the fuel in the economy. So that's how we got the big 27%. That's part of how we got the 27% increase. Now, the other part of that that was unusual is that the banks were creating a lot of credit, mm-hmm. because corporations had very large credit lines to the banks. Once the pandemic hit, they became panicked. They said, God, we better draw on those credit lines. We don't know what's going to happen. We need the cash. So when they received the loans, activated those credit lines, what happened? The deposits they had in the banking system went up, and deposits are part of the money supply. The money supply, Keith, 76% of the money supply are deposits in the banking system. Only 11% is currency in circulation, you know, notes and coins. And about 5% is made up of small time deposits, and 8% retail money market funds. So the big bulk, 70, you know, roughly three quarters of the money supply is all sucked up by deposits of one sort or another in the banking system. So you got to look at the balance sheets of the banks and the deltas in those things to figure out really what's going on. And if you add, you know, another 11% being taken up by currency in circulation. You pretty much have the picture there. You got 85% of the whole thing is deposits in the banking system and just notes and coins in circulation.
Mm-hmm. That's so that, like, help me tie that together then. So, and I'll just show a couple pictures so people can see what we're talking about, guys. Show slide 110 that shows, you know, because the G in C plus I plus G, as Professor Hanke would teach his students, you know, that's, you know, that's a number. It's a big number. It's generally 17%, or on average 17% of GDP, but it contributed closer to 24% of it in 2023. And then back to Steve's point on slide 118, the deficit, you know, ended up going to 1.7, 1.8 trillion and counting. So, you know, how do you take, like, because we went from 27% money supply growth to down 4.5 since March of 2022, I think you said, right? And, you know, just looking at the chart,
yes,
that's accurate. Obviously, yeah. It's a time series. Everyone can see that.
Yeah. But so the key thing, put that chart back up with those red bars.
Yep.
Yeah,
that,
right.
That's,
yeah, you see that deficit. What I'm saying is that a big chunk of those red bars was monetized by the Fed.
Now, yes.
What does it mean, again, to repeat, that the Treasury sold bonds. Those bonds, they sold them to broker dealers, and then the Fed comes in and buys those, and when they do, the deposits in the banking system go up because the Fed credits the individuals who've been buying the bonds.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
And, so at any rate, the red part of the thing gets transformed into, if you had a line for M2, it would be shooting up, you know, skyrocketing up. Where those red bars are, you'd see the money supply. If you had those overlaid with some kind of on a bar chart, they'd be going up very rapidly.
Right. And now we're going into the hangover period. I mean, so that. Yeah, as we
right.
like to say, you have to comp those comparisons or comp the comps of the most epic money supply growth in human history, or certainly of the modern era. Because all the other dates that you gave, Steve, which is a great economics lesson, history lesson at the very minimum, are all dates before World War II.
Right? Oh, along ancient history. I mean, even to get the data on those things, you have to, you know, scramble around because it's a long time ago.
Yeah, exactly. So that's my next question is, you know, if you're like a Fed apologist or a, you know, we can get into MMT too, because this didn't exactly all go down the way that the prior Fed might have done, because you had Yellen in there doing what she was doing, which we can discuss. But you have this, you know, they would say, well, Steve, we're going to cut interest rates like six times, and then the money supply is going to start to go up again. Like, that's what Wall Street keeps saying. I mean, essentially, as the economy is slowing, and it slowed dramatically in rate of change terms between the second quarter, and basically the rate of change data from late July all the way to October, when the Fed, when Powell finally said, okay, I'll consider some rate cuts. I mean, if and when the Fed is cutting interest rates, does that change the calculus on money supply?
Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Hope you're enjoying our podcasts. Start generating alpha with our suite of Sector Pro investing research products. Dive deep into retail, industrials, technology, and everything in between with exclusive access to the sharpest analysts and actionable ideas on Wall Street. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Well, to quote or paraphrase Milton Friedman, monetary policy is not about interest rates. It's about changes in the money supply. So if you read the press and the narrative in the press, all of it will be always talking about interest rates.
Right.
And the thing to be focusing on is something no one ever talks about, and that's the money supply.
Mm-hmm.
What's going on with the money supply? Now, the big factor, we've had an enormous increase in the federal funds rates, yes, but we've also had And the thing, the big driver in this has been quantitative tightening. Mm-hmm. The Fed shrinking its balance sheet and running off the bonds that it has on its balance sheet. Now, that directly reduces the money supply. And so QT is in gear. It's reducing the money supply. The increase in the Fed funds rate is a indirect and kind of fuzzy connection with changes in the money supply. I'm not saying it has nothing to do with it, as would be implied by that quote I gave you from Milton Friedman, but it's not really the main driver in the thing. Although the credit being extended by the banking system is plummeted, then it's essentially zero. Mm-hmm. Loans being made by the banking system are essentially zero. And the banking system, by the way, is in fact a big engine that changes the rate of growth in the money supply, and the fuel going into the economy are loans being emitted by the banking system. So right now, we've got the Fed quantitative tightening, shrinking. We've got that's one contributor.
Yep.
To the money supply, a contractor actually now. And the other contractor is the commercial banking system, which it's actually contracting.
Yes.
So you add two negatives, and you get a negative number.
Yep. That's so. Just to show what Steve's saying here, on slide 125, this is I think a pretty good chart, Steve, that shows what we call there's a question going to be embedded in this. So it shows the QT or the quantitative tightening countdown. Slightly delayed, yeah, but this thing's been consistent because that's what they're doing. So we're projecting that this finally, at least kind of sometime around May, is like there's maybe that's a spot where you get less QT in rate of change terms. But I always think in rate of change terms, right? I mean, I don't think in I don't think that this doesn't matter. This has obviously been additive to your point on contracting the money supply. So what do you think happens after like May?
Well, first of all, let me comment on your rate of change. You nailed it, because everything in economics happens at the margin, and at the margin, what is the margin? The margin is the incremental change. Or as you put it, the rate of change, or technically really the first derivative of whatever the function happens to be that you're dealing with. So that's the way you have to look at these things. Rate of change is the key. Now, what's going to be happening after May? Well, we don't know what's going to be happening after May, because the Fed has been kind of bobbing and weaving on this thing, depending. They are looking at real-time data. The Fed is data-driven. So whatever they're doing, they look at, for example, financial conditions indices, and those are all current data that come out. So the wind changes from day to day. And that means the Fed changes from day to day, week to week. So we don't really know what they're doing. It looked like they were going to be stopping the QT and lowering the Fed funds rate quite early, maybe in March or something like that. Now, given the picture as they see it with the current data coming through and what appears to be a strong economy, this has all been pushed back.
Yeah.
The whole idea of loosening up has been pushed way back into May, or maybe even June or something like that. But that could change tomorrow depending on what the data that are coming through. My point is the following. As an old school monetarist, I look at the equation of exchange, MV. Money times velocity equals PY, the price level times Y, the real rate of growth in the economy. And if you transform that into logs, differentiate it, calculate what the hanky golden growth rate should be for the money supply to be able to hit the Fed target of 2%, you end up with a number of 6%.
Wow.
And that 6% number is a lot different than what we have right now, which is a decline in the money supply of we're down at negative about 2.1 right now year over year. It's about two year over year negative. So. So what they should be doing right now, not in May or June or March or whatever, if you had people paying attention to the money supply at the Fed and people who knew what they were doing, actually, they should be targeting 6% thereabouts for growth rate in the money supply measured by M2. It's wow. Contracting. It's contracting year over year by 2%. That would imply that they should be right now stopping quantitative tightening right now. I would stop it. I would stop it right now. And I would signal that there would probably be early reductions in Fed funds. Fed funds would be going down.
Yeah.
And why not? Look at the inflation. I said that's baked in the cake. That was all determined. What's going on with inflation was determined a year and a half ago with the contracting money supply. So where are we with this? The consumer price index is at 3.1% and going down. The producer price index, Keith, is minus 1% roughly. And it's plus 1%, not minus. It's going down, but it's still positive, but it's below 2%. And the personal consumption expenditures index, which is the thing the Fed likes, that's down at 2.4% and going down. So all the measures of inflation are going down, exactly what Greenwood and I predicted would happen with this contraction in the money supply. The fuel for the economy is run out. It's gone negative. Inflation is falling. Now, by the way, talking about inflation in the markets, there's a lot of agitation over the 10-year yield. What's going on with the 10-year? Well, the yield on the 10-year is going to go down. And it's going to go down because the bond yields follow changes in inflation. If you think inflation is going to be 2% or less by the end of this year, you know that the current yield on the 10-year is going to go down from where it is now. So long government bonds with long duration are probably a pretty wise place to be, particularly given the stock market, which is by any standard pretty pricey right now.
Pretty pricey.
Why do you think Warren Buffett has accumulated such a mountain of cash?
Well, he also has the insurance company, which is earning super premiums on a lot right now. But a pile like Warren Buffett, you're right. I mean, just taking a step back, though, I think you're very unique in a lot of ways. But one, like when you're a Fed critic, you know, people will typically say, well, you don't believe in, you know, money printing and again, we get that there's a difference between cutting interest rates and again, rest in peace, Milton Friedman. But again, we understand the difference. But a lot of people won't say what you said, which is, look, you should have already got on with it. You should already be cutting interest rates and most importantly, increasing the money supply. and you conversely, correct me if I'm wrong, but you know, back in 2021, you'd say that this is lunacy to believe that 27% money supply growth isn't going to create 9% inflation. Because back then, of course, the Fed and all the establishment econs thought, okay, maybe we'll get 2-3% inflation, not 6 and then 9. So what I love about that is that you know, your view, like how you would lead the Fed, goes both ways. You know, it's subjective, right? I mean, it's that to me, do I have that right? Like, by the way, you would say you're being too aggressive and then now you're too late?
No, yeah, I would put it this way. I'm not being subjective. I'm being objective.
Yeah.
And what's the message? The big message is steady as you go. Keep the money supply at about 6%, and you will see the inflation coming in pretty close to 2%.
Yeah,
that's what I'm saying. Now, what the Fed has done, they've given us a massive roller coaster ride. They aren't steady as you go. They're up, they're down, they're up, they're down. They're all over the place because they're not looking at the money supply. They're looking at these current data. It's like your finger in the wind. That's their model. It's a finger in the wind. And as a result of that, we're getting a whiplash. First we go up, then we go down. So that's the Fed. Now, what's the narrative? You started getting into the narrative. The narrative of the Fed, which has been bought into by, quite frankly, all the press and most of the economics profession, and that is that the inflation, they never mention money, by the way. It is not in the post-Keynesian models, by the way. The main models that are used in macroeconomics do not include a variable for an aggregate measure of the money supply.
So the
research economists that have been trained in the last 20 years, they don't even have it in the model. They don't have it in their head. They're not even thinking about it. And the Fed, as a matter of policy, by the way, does not think about it. Powell has been on the record over and over and over again saying that the money supply doesn't have much to do with the course of the economy, or as I put it earlier, nominal GDP or inflation or real growth in the economy. So that's their policy position. Now why is that? I said the research models aren't there. That's one reason. But they have 785 economists at the Fed who haven't been able to predict anything, by the way, nothing. And the ratio of Democrats to Republicans is 48.5-1. They're almost all Democrats. Now, in the sphere of economics, who do Democrats, what's their number one target that they put an X on the guy's back? It's Milton Friedman.
Exactly.
It happens that Milton Friedman is the dean of the quantity theory of money, by the way, which has been used by almost all economists since the 16th century. This is nothing new. And for your viewers or anyone with any common sense knows that if you goose the money supply, eventually you're going to get an economy that's too hot and generates inflation. And if you contract the money supply, for example, like those four historical cases that I gave you, you're eventually going to get a recession. I mean, that's basically the model. Forgetting the algebra and the differential equations and all that stuff, it's basically fuel in the system. You have an economy, you goose it with fuel and you get red hot. You're going to go too fast, and if you slow down and drain the fuel out of the tank, you're going to slow down and have a recession. So what you want to do, you want to keep the fuel kind of constant going in at about 6%, and if you do that, you're going to see the economy pretty steady and the inflation rate pretty steady at about 2%. We had a lot of that, by the way, in the 1990s. What why do you think we had that result in the 1990s? Mm-hmm. If you look at the growth rate in the money supply, and the Fed wasn't necessarily being run by pure monetarists. I mean, Greenspan was the chairman of the Fed, but it worked out that that's what happened. Pretty steady growth in the money supply, pretty steady growth in the economy, pretty steady growth in inflation.
Hi, Robert McGrory here, Director of Subscriber Development at Hedgeye. Join our entire research analyst team live before the market opens for deep dive investing analysis, our favorite stock ideas, and our risk manager in chief, Keith McCullough's macro overlay. Our team of 40 plus equity analysts discuss key market developments, trends, and our high conviction long and short investing ideas. You will not get this granular level of insight anywhere else. A video replay, audio version, and analyst summary notes from the call are available shortly after each live show to ensure you don't miss anything. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe and tune in live to the call weekdays at 7:45 a.m. Eastern. Enjoy the rest of this episode.
Well, I mean, let's just start in the 1990s. Milton Friedman wasn't dead. So there's that. That's a big thing when the dean is still alive and watching and paying attention. It's an amazing thing, like when you state it so plainly and how far we've become, like, you know, never mind as a profession in my case on Wall Street, but academia, I mean, so far lost. So far lost. I mean, it's not only the
academic thing, but the main message comes from the big central banks, the Fed, the Bank of England,
yeah,
and the ECB. Now, their narrative, by the way, what is the narrative? Once inflation broke out, they didn't want the noose around their neck. And like every central banker, when inflation breaks out, people don't like inflation. So they have to blame it on somebody else. You know, it's not me, it's the guy behind the tree kind of thing.
Yeah.
And how did they do it in the pandemic? Commodity prices and supply chains. You're still reading about commodity changes, price changes, and supply chain. One reason they say inflation has settled down is because the supply chain problem has been fixed. You don't read anything about the reason that the inflation has collapsed is because the money supply has collapsed. It's because productivity has increased. Silicon Valley is coming online with AI and all of this business. Supply chains, the ports are running fine now, and
yeah,
so
it's like wah wah wah. I generally speaking, I just loathe narratives. I mean, narratives are for people who have no experience, practical experience, or successful experience. You know, that'd be a relatively high bar just to start with. But I mean, it requires no experience or success modeling anything to believe something. I mean, that's the point, is that when you have 785 econs that are trained in a certain way, and to your point, 48, that's an incredible statistic, Steve. 48-1 is the ratio, like, politicized econs at the Fed?
Well,
I mean, that's nuts.
And it's getting worse because the Republicans are the old-timers in there, so they're dying off.
Well, that's a thing that I'm very concerned about. I mean, I'm actually no spring chicken anymore. They attempted to traditionally train me in economics at Yale. I don't know if you do that or not, but I mean, I really struggled in the first couple of years there because it just didn't make any common sense. Now, if you start to, you know, people that I learned from at Yale, Benoit Mandelbrot, which people thought was off his rocker. But again, he's measuring rates of change, nonlinearity, et cetera, over there in the corner. You have Bob Shiller, who's showing big mean reversions across cycles. And then you had all the bullshit, right? Like all the linear econs. So I was like, but I today, man, like I'll be 50. So anyone that is of these 785 econs at the Fed that are of my class or Generation X. We're all screwed up as Gen X guys, right? Because we don't trust anything. But we probably shouldn't trust these people because they haven't incorporated Milton Friedman at a base level in their model. It's crazy.
Well, Keith, I won't admit how old I am. I'm a little older than you are.
Just a little. You look better, though.
Certainly, I'm old enough to be your father.
But, yeah.
But let's get back to the Generation X not trusting anything. Hanke's 95% rule, and what I drill into all my students is 95% of what you read in the press, the narrative, is either wrong or irrelevant.
Right.
And that's why you have to be to spend quite a bit of time thinking about these things, because the narrative is repeated over and over again. It's like a brainwashing. It's like the drip thing. Oh. Every day you pick up the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, you're going to find the same narrative about what's going on with inflation, and it will always have a bunch of specific prices, commodity prices, rents, used cars, you name it. That's one thing. Or it'll be talking about something about the supply chains. Mm-hmm. It will never, ever, ever mention changes in the money supply, ever.
Right. You know what would be very good? I mean, we like to think of Hedge Eye TV as an educational platform and as much as anything else. But, I mean, there's no politics either. But I thought she did I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. Jennifer Burns just wrote The Last Conservative, which was at least a book about Milton Friedman that nobody really written before. I thought she did a very good job, like in points in time, like when you're doing that hanky, like just keep it steady. I mean, there's an entire section of the Milton Friedman history where he says just that, and his old buddy from New York, Arthur Burns, he's like, look, dude, you're not listening. You're not listening to Hanke's, to what you're saying is the rule. And then they got in a fight. I thought the whole thing, like, for somebody who's been educated in all the, all the stuff. I mean, I found that was like a really good tribute, but I also found it to be quite ironic. And we're talking about like last year, that was top 30 nonfiction book, in terms of the ranks. Like, people are reading this book, but this is in no way being applied to our current monetary or fiscal policy.
I thought Jennifer Burns's book on Milton was a good read. It's the kind of thing you can read before driving without being in danger. And what, if you look in the index on that thing, Keith, you'll find a listing for Hanke.
Yes, yes.
So she did pay attention to what Greenwood and I were forecasting on inflation, and said, there were monetarists around, and the ones who were applying monetary theory properly got the inflation thing right. So I have to, in a way, applaud her for that, because most people just deep six that. I mean, we had very, very few people acknowledge that we nailed it. And the reason why is it doesn't fit into the narrative.
Right.
We don't fit into the thing. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned, by the way, one of your professors was Bob Shiller at Yale, great economist. I looking at the stock market right now, I haven't looked at Shiller lately, but I assume he thinks it's very pricey right now.
Oh, the CAPE ratio or anything that has to do with... Yeah, I mean, valuation be damned. Once you go to... And this is the lesson, of modern history, I suppose. I mean... If Hanke's telling you that 27% money supply growth is going to give you 9% inflation, well, you can take whatever valuation model you were selling stocks on and you could throw it out the window, because nobody's ever seen those levels, not even remotely close. So that's what we got. We got the bubbles. I call it Moab, mother of all bubbles. I mean, and it wouldn't be a bubble if it wouldn't keep going up.
Hi, I'm Keith McCullough, and I wanted to introduce you to my favorite product at HedgeEye, the Macro Show. Why is it my favorite product? Well, it's my show. I do that every morning. If you want to get ready for the market day, you want to contextualize all the data, you want to make good decisions, then this is what you should be watching. It's a repeatable process that you can deliberately study, measuring and mapping
time series to time series of data. So it's not going headline to headline and getting whipped around. It's actually being so much more dispassionate about it and making good decisions that are data driven. So we'd love to have you on our team. Come join us.
Tune in weekdays at 9 a.m. Eastern and on demand anytime. Go to hedgeye.com/research to subscribe.
Right. Of course, it kind of, in a way, it's a, the market index is a little bit of an illusion because you got the Magnificent Seven driving the whole thing.
Right.
And it's the market's not really very broadly based. But at any rate, given the fact that let's move now from the kind of monetary economics into the market just a little bit. And that is, let us assume that Greenwood and Hanke are right about the recession coming late this year. What does that imply about the market? It implies that earnings are probably going to weaken up, okay? Free cash flow will become weaker. And discounting that lower flow of free cash flow, as markets tend to do, that will drive those multiples down and the market will come off these pricey levels. So recessions really are not a great thing for the stock market.
No.
To put it bluntly. And there are kind of signs in the wind, so to speak, that things are starting to weaken around the edges. That's my interpretation as I'm reading the data, and you get certain things like the leading indicators have been very weak actually for a long time. So that's a more traditional way to look at business cycles, but they have been quite weak, signaling some things are going to weaken up. If not have a recession, we'll have, you know, big slowdown. You've got a negative yield curve, which virtually always predicts a recession. So there are things that are out there that are consistent with this baked in the cake recession idea that's based on monetary analysis.
Yeah, the what I struggle with is the recession we already had. Like back to the, like, look at this chart, Steve, slide 45, guys. I always show this because I think it's funny to talk to people on Wall Street that are recession deniers, like in a lot of different ways. Go back a slide, one more. Because you had like X-Mag 7, what this one's showing you at the bottom in particular was that this wasn't like a recession in Russell 2000 net income growth. It was a depression, Steve. I mean, and it started not yesterday, right? So we had like, and this is like the rolling question in my mind. I mean, and as I said at the outset, it's not like we didn't have an industrial and manufacturing recession. I mean, the durable goods number that was reported last week was a negative year over year number. I mean, it was a 42 month, talk about rate of change, which is not on that chart. It was a 42 month rate of change low, Steve. So like, that's what I struggle with, is that the recession, we've had a recession in big countries too. Where you haven't had it is where that bubble money went. Like, if you look at NASDAQ earnings growth compared to that, like currently it's running 91 companies in the NASDAQ 100 have reported like over 30% earnings growth. So I think that's the real big one is when the rate of change of technological or AI or whatever growth, I mean, when that starts to slow in rate of change terms and goes negative, I mean, there's a recommendation for that, which is called prayer. I mean, I don't know when that's going to happen. But I mean, what do you think about the divergence between what I just said? Like, I mean, you and I don't have to apologize for having like leading indicators is a very good point. Leading indicators predicts the industrial recession, which we had. It didn't predict that we were going to have AI. I mean, obviously, there are
right.
a lot of different things here.
So I think what you're pointing out, what you've just done is, you've listened to what I said, and I said, you know, it looks like we got a recession baked in the cake due to this contraction in the money supply. Money supply is the fuel for the economy. It's going negative and so forth. And then you're throwing up a lot of data that are consistent with that.
Right.
If I can use the word narrative, I know you don't like it, but let's use the word story.
Or so, rate of change slowdown. That's like those.
Yeah, no. Let's go old school. Narrative is a new thing. That's a new, jargon that's out there. But it's a story. The recession story. And you say, well, I'm looking at data, and it looks to me like some of these data are very much in line with what you're saying, and maybe they're even ahead of you. Maybe they're saying chapter one of your story is already out there.
Yeah. Yeah, big time. I mean, there's no denying that. And that explains, when you tie it back to markets, why, the Russell 2000 is still down 15% versus where it was when money supply growth was 27% in 2021. No. So, I mean, the Russell 2000 companies didn't generate enough AI or enough narrative.
Here's the thing that's a real problem for people and even analysts who spend all their time working on this kind of stuff. There are long and variable lags between changes in the money supply. The key causative factor in all of this is changes in the money supply. But there are long and variable lags between changes in the money supply and changes in asset prices and changes in economic activity and changes in inflation. Now, I just spoke to John Greenwood yesterday. He, as you know, lives in London, even though he's a fellow at my Institute for Applied Economics at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore, but he resides in London. And he was looking at the British economy to see if there had been any episodes like the four episodes that I gave you in the U.S. where the money supply actually contracted. And he could only find one. But, and as I recall, he told me it was 2001. And it took 3 years before the recession hit. 3 years. So that's these lags can be tremendously long. And if you're not aware and used to analyzing in the context that we're talking about right now, you're never going to get this, because people looking at what's happening or what they think is going to happen today, they're not thinking about what was going on with the money supply 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm. He'd know, because he worked on the buy side too, right? Do I have that right?
Well, remember, John, for many years, was a chief economist at Invesco.
Right, exactly.
And very, very experienced. He also, by the way, was the one who was the architect that put in the currency board in Hong Kong in 1983 that stopped the currency crisis and is a system they have now. Mm-hmm. The Hong Kong Monetary Authority, the currency board component of that, was designed by Greenwood, who was in Hong Kong at the time.
I love that. You guys are just, you found each other, obviously, he found you. But you really have an opportunity here. I wonder if you think that it's still as blazingly obvious as it is. I mean, to stand on the shoulders of Milton Friedman should be something that at least 50% of aspiring economists do from here on out. But that doesn't seem to be the case. Everybody's dialing up, Steve Hanke and Greenwood to take their views. In fact, they're trying to hide your views.
I would say kind of depersonalizing it, the quantity theory of money is basically been canceled.
Right.
That's the bottom line. Now, why is that? It's the central banks who have actually done it, because if you abide by the quantity theory of money, you have to focus on the money supply. And who's in control of monetary policy and the money supply? The central banks.
Right.
And the central banks want no responsibility for anything. None. And the best way to get the monkey off their back is to dump the quantity theory of money completely and get money out of the picture. If you get money out of the picture and say it's irrelevant, it's interesting, you basically are saying that the central banks are irrelevant.
Yes. Well, I mean, it's
stupidity of the highest order.
But
actually,
if you love AI, right? What I think is fascinating on a lot of levels is Wall Street in particular, and what I affectionately call old wall media. And I'd agree with you that the number is at least 95%. I mean, the reason why CNBC is the longest running comedy on cable is for good reason. I mean, it's not Seinfeld couldn't even last 10 years. I mean, so you have this situation where everyone loves knowledge, but I mean, just study Milton Friedman, plug MV equals PY into your AI machine, and you would actually, correct me if I'm wrong, but if you took over, which I know you don't want to do, but if you did, wouldn't you have it sounds like it's a rules-based, like a pretty steadfast rules-based, you know, solution for monetary for monetary policy, where you wouldn't need seven economists, never mind 785 of them.
Yeah, right. It is rule-based. That's the key word, rule.
Right.
If you had a rule, you wouldn't be riding on a roller coaster. You wouldn't have to have a safety belt at all.
Right. Like, I guess we can wrap up on that. Like, what is the pushback to that? Because Milton Friedman had a lot of pushback, clearly, but he ended up winning
I think, of course, Milton was, you know, one of my mentors and a lightning rod. But I think the fundamental pushback is the fact that, shall we say, the Yale models of macroeconomics have won the day, and one reason they have has nothing to do really with the models, the elegance of the models or anything like that, or empirical data. Clearly nothing to do with empirical data in the real world. They are convenient for the Fed and the central banks because it eliminates money from the picture.
Yeah.
And if you eliminate money from the picture, you can't blame the Fed for inflation or bad economic times.
Right.
It's not me. It's the guy behind the tree.
It's the supply chain.
Right. No.
I tell you, you're so right. I mean, they would all lose their jobs, 785 econs. They'd have to be transparent and accountable and, in the end, responsible. So I guess that's it. I mean, you're not going to have that.
See, the proof of the pudding here, let's get down to the bottom line. We're just about winding up here. And that is, the proof of the pudding is in the eating. Well, Greenwood and I used the quantity theory of money, and we got it right.
Mm-hmm.
They are using post-Keynesian models, and they were clueless. They never saw the inflation coming, and they have no idea where they are right now. I'd like to say it's like flying a plane blind, you know, flying blind. You got an altimeter in your plane. It should have the money supply on it. It has nothing on it.
Well, I guess that's why they're all so adept at talking about flying planes. Soft landing, no, we've even heard no landing, hard landing, medium landing.
Now what they're saying is there might be a touchdown.
Yeah, there you go.
And a takeoff. See, now the narrative, the story is the following. Okay, the inflation's coming down, but oh, with all this AI and productivity and wonderful things coming, it might turn around and start going up. So now it isn't a hard landing. That's over. It isn't a soft landing. It's a touchdown, and then we take off again.
Yeah, you ever see people, like, if you've been on a plane when that happens, people really like that, right? That touchdown thing. Not at all.
As a pilot, I don't mind touching down.
Yeah, you do, but I'm not the one flying. Like, yeah, it's Steve. You're the man. I sincerely appreciate, like, just what you've contributed and continue to contribute. Because again, there aren't many times in your profession where you're going to be able to make a call against all these econs that's that precise at the, as Benoit Mandelbrot would say, like at the particular point in cycle time that mattered, like you like you said, the proof's in the pudding. And I think more people should be listening.
We're gonna mount this program because you realize that we actually are acknowledged that we hit the bullseye. No one else will even admit it.
That's just because I'm a nice Canadian guy. You know, that's what we do, I guess.
It is
actually quite sad that in America that it takes a Canadian to stand up and say something like that, or talk about liberty.
I mean, to tell you the truth, I was almost going to say, God, this is a first.
Yeah, it is. Well, thanks for your time, but also thank you for all your contributions and all your teachings, not obviously just to me in this audience today, but everyone that spans, you know, the spheres of Steve Hanke. So thank you very, very much.
Well, thank you for having me, Keith. Great to be with you again. Thanks.
We'll see you again. He is the one and only. If you haven't considered all this stuff, I just really want you to take a step back, right? I'm a Canadian. Like, I have a green card. I have a beautiful American family. I think a good American firm that we're building here that's based on an apolitical exercise. It's rules-based, again, measuring and mapping data. But you, if you're an American, like, what are you doing? What are you doing allowing 785 economists at the Fed with a ratio of 48-1 to one party and get it dead wrong? Just asking, right? Thanks for joining us.
Don't forget to check out hedgeye.com to get more actionable investing insights from our team of more than 40 research analysts. And check us out on Twitter at our handle, @hedgeye. This presentation is informational only. None of the information contained herein constitutes an offer to sell or a solicitation of an offer to buy any security or investment vehicle, nor does it constitute investment recommendation or legal, tax, accounting, or investment advice by Hedgeye or any of its employees, officers, agents, or guests. This information is presented without regard for individual investment preferences or risk parameters and is general, non-tailored, non-specific information. This content is based on information from sources believed to be reliable. Hedgeye is not responsible for errors, inaccuracies, or omissions of information. The opinions and conclusions contained in this report are those of the individual expressing those opinions and conclusions and are intended solely for the use of Hedgeye subscribers and the authorized recipients of the contents. All investments entail a certain degree of risk, and financial instrument prices can fluctuate based on several factors, including those not considered in the preparation of the content. Consult your financial professional before investing. The information contained herein is protected by United States and foreign copyright laws and is intended solely for the use of its authorized recipient. Access must be provided directly by Hedgeye. Redistribution or republication is strictly prohibited. For more detail, please refer to the terms of service at hedgeye.com/terms of service.